We as humans are used to feeling pretty self-sufficient, but the truth is that a large part of our food supply relies on other creatures to pollinate the crops. Bees are one of the most important pollinators around, and as we've heard in recent years, they are in trouble. There's exciting research going on at UW-Madison that aims to collect data about bees and their habits, and we're going to learn about that today. Claudio Gertan is a professor of entomology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is also associated with the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Claudio, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Judith.
Great to have you here, and also great to have Jeremy Hemberger. He's a graduate student of entomology at UW-Madison. He's interested in the intersection of several fields, including entomology, ecology, conservation, and evolution, and his current research focuses on bumblebee foraging. Jeremy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
Well, this is just a really great topic because there is so much interest in pollinators, I think, but, you know, I think a lot of people feel like, oh, but what can we do? You know, things are out of our hands. But let's talk first, just really basically, Claudio, maybe you can tell us, what types of insects and animals serve as pollinators?
Yeah, so pollinators is such a broad term, and we have all kinds of things that visit plants, visit flowers, so that they can move pollen around and allow the fertilization of the plants. So things like bats and birds are pollinators, but really the most effective pollinators are insects. And of these insects, we probably are very familiar with butterflies as pollinators. We see them on our flowers all the time. But really, it's bees that are the champions of pollination. And we're probably used to, when we talk about bees, everyone's familiar with honeybees. Mm-hmm. And those are really the workhorse of the agricultural sector right now. The honeybees, you see them in the white boxes, and farmers bring them out to their fields, and that's really what is responsible for the majority of pollination. But the reality is that that's one species, and there are actually many, many species. There are about 20,000 species of wild bees around the world, and here in Wisconsin, there's probably at least 500 species of wild pollinators that we find. Over 100 of them we find in our crops, in apple orchards and in cranberry orchards. So these are really the ones that we're interested in addition to honeybees, of course.
And so we're saying that they're pollinators, but what are they? I don't think that they're just saying, oh, we've got to pollinate this for everybody else. What are they doing for themselves that then results in pollination of these plants?
That's a wonderful question, and I think it actually goes to the heart of how we can actually help them in the long run. So as pollinators, what the bees are really doing is they're going for two things. They're going for nectar, for sugar. That's the thing that ultimately makes honey by the honeybees that we enjoy so much. Mm-hmm. And they also go for pollen, which is for them a protein source. That's actually kind of their main food item that they feed to their young. And so the bees are actually foraging. They're actually feeding, looking for those food items that they can use, some for themselves and some for their offspring.
So, Jeremy, you're interested in bee foraging. So really, they're foraging for sustenance for themselves and their young, and then they're doing us this huge favor kind of as just a happy consequence.
Yep, that's correct.
And so we've heard a lot about colony collapse in the last few years. Claudio, what's the status of that right now?
Yeah, that's a really interesting syndrome, almost. So what happened in, maybe just to kind of back up a little bit, colony collapse was something that was described maybe in the mid-2000s, where beekeepers would come back to their hives, honeybeekeepers would come back to their hives in the spring, they would open up their hives, and it would be completely empty. And this was very frightening. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that there was a pile of dead bees at the bottom, they were just completely empty. And so people started speculating about what the causes were of these strange disappearances of honeybees, and you can imagine there were all kinds of interesting and wacky ideas, including alien abductions and cell phone towers being responsible for the demise of honeybees. What I think we've been learning is that it's actually a very complex series of events that are happening to cause bees to not do so well, including having these behaviors that may lead them astray from their hives so that they actually can't find their way back.
Wow.
So what we've been finding is that colony collapse is associated with a series of symptoms that we probably can't pin to any one cause. Okay. I think this is the best consensus that scientists have been coming to. one of the things that people have talked about is pesticides mm-hmm. in the environment.
And is it specifically, I'm probably going to massacre the same, but neonicotinoids?
But you've said it perfectly, yeah. Neonicotinoids are one class of compounds that have been used very frequently as of late. And they have lethal effects on insects. Obviously, they're used for pest management. They're very important in agricultural management. But they also have sublethal effects. That is, they don't outright kill bees, but they affect their behavior. And so it's thought that some of these behaviors may cause them to actually lose track and not be able to find their hives, not mm-hmm. be able to return. There's also the discovery of several new pathogens here in the U.S., viruses and other things that have been responsible for the decline of bees. And there are also other parasites that actually have been very well identified. One particularly noxious one called the varroa mite. It has the specific name of the varroa destructor, just to give you an idea of how nasty of an organism this is. And they're basically like little vampires. They sit on the outside of the bees and actually suck them dry slowly.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and this is inside the hive. And beekeepers have really struggled to manage varroa mite, which is really one of the main challenges. So when you put all these things together, and then you add on top of that, that our landscapes are really different today than what they used to be, say, 50 years ago. Our landscapes are, in some parts of the country, dominated by single monocultures of crops that are annual. They mm-hmm. show up during only a certain period of time. And a lot of them don't actually offer that much for bees to start with. And so when you talk to the to beekeepers, the old timers, they say, you know, the bees just don't have the amount of food mm-hmm. that they used to.
Or the variety. And I'm assuming that, like for any creature, variety is good.
Exactly, yeah. In fact, there's some research coming out right now that's suggesting that for bees, if they mix up pollen sources, that's actually much better for them and for their immune system than if they only feed on one type of pollen. So when you add all these things together, then you have this very complex situation where bees don't do very well. And what we were finding maybe in the 80s is that overwintering losses of bees tended to be in the 10 to 20%. And that was pretty typical. I mean, you can have a harsh winter and the colonies just can't make it through. But now those numbers are closer to 30%. And in some years, in some states, they're even as high as 50%.
Wow.
So 50% of the hives that go into the winter, the beekeepers come back the next spring and they've died or they are gone or whatever, wow. Whatever the case may be.
So obviously colony collapse is a big concern, but I didn't realize there were so many species of bees. Does colony collapse affect all species of bees or just honeybees? Jeremy?
So colony collapse is pretty much exclusively a honeybee phenomenon. The wild bees that we see, so the bumblebees, sweat bees, and mason bees, aren't affected by colony collapse per se. They're not social species like honeybees are. Some are like bumblebees. They're kind of a eusocial or they're semi-social. But they don't accumulate the same numbers of individuals that honeybee colonies do. So the things that we work on, like bumblebees, we really don't have to worry about that. But they are still affected by some of the same drivers that are causing colony collapse, the pesticides, the changes in our land. Exactly,
yeah.
Yep.
And it just also because while our bats in Wisconsin are not pollinators, but, you know, it kind of reminds me of the white nose syndrome, that it affects cave bats because they are clustered together and the cave conditions are really good for that kind of that fungus. So it kind of reminds me of the colony collapse. And while not all of them are affected, it's certainly cause for concern.
Definitely.
Yeah, in fact, most species of bees actually are not social.
Hmm.
So when you cram, like you said, Judith, when you cram a lot of individuals together, the likelihood that a pathogen can move from one to the other is very high. And
right.
that's when you have these group situations, that's when you're most susceptible. Most bees, on the other hand, are solitary. You probably don't know this, but there's a single mom, and she finds a nesting site someplace. Most often it's in the ground. She digs a little hole in the ground and then creates these little chambers, these little areas underground where she lays an egg. And with the egg, she provisions it with a little packet of pollen that when the egg hatches out, the larva basically feeds on that pollen.
Mm.
You see this also in, they will also sometimes nest in the stems of grasses or in hollow openings and things like that. So they don't, and they do this by themselves. And then mom just kind of keeps laying a different batch of eggs and provisions it with the pollen. So bees need food, as we were talking about. They also need places to make these nests, right. And they need shelter. They need homes, just kind of like we do.
We are talking with Claudio Gertan and Jeremy Hemberger. They are entomologists, a professor of entomology and a student of entomology at UW-Madison. And we're talking about pollinators and specifically a really fascinating project about tagging bumblebees to learn more about them so we can learn how to support them. If you have questions about pollinators, specifically the Bumblebee Project, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question or comment on the Facebook page. Well, we're going to go to the news in just about a minute, Jeremy, but I just want to give people a little teaser here. You are tagging bumblebees.
That is correct,
How are you tagging them?
So what we're doing is basically creating a little iPass system for bumblebees. It's a good way to think about it. So we're taking these little tiny radio transmitters that are about the size of a grain of rice and super gluing them to the backs of bumblebees. And as they come in and out of their nest, we're able to track how long they're out foraging for floral resources like pollen and nectar. And we're also able to track how many times they go out, how long they rest in between each time they go out, and then use all of those data to kind of get an idea of if there's a signal, perhaps, from the resources in the landscape that they're foraging in. So if there are a ton of flowers, are they out foraging for a short amount of time? Or if there are only a couple flowers out there, are they out foraging for longer so they can actually find those?
Mm-hmm. Wow. So we're talking about very small insects with even tinier, I almost think of it as a Fitbit.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, where they're going, how active they are, how many floors they're walking down.
Yep, exactly.
Well, there's so much more to talk about this project. It's really exciting, and it's so exciting that it's happening right here at UW. We will be back with Claudio Gertan and Jeremy Hemberger after a quick look at the news from NPR and WPR. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz is our on-air producer. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's really no exaggeration to say that the fate of each species has an impact on the rest of the ecosystem in which they live. And in the case of pollinators, their decline has far-reaching implications for humans and other species as well. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Good to have you along with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're finding out about some really fascinating research going on at UW-Madison. Claudio Gertan is a professor of entomology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he is also associated with the Wisconsin Energy Institute. Claudio, thanks again for spending time with us today.
You're welcome, Judith.
And Jeremy Hemberger is a graduate student of entomology at UW-Madison. He's interested in the intersection of entomology, ecology, conservation, and evolution, and his current research focuses on bumblebee foraging. Jeremy, good to have you with us as well.
Thank you. You too, Judith.
So we started talking a little bit before the news about this really amazing project where you are actually fitting bumblebees with little tracking devices. First of all, who developed the actual little tracking device? Because that seems like a big project right there in and of itself.
It is, yeah. So this is actually a technology that's been typically used for fisheries research.
Oh.
And I've kind of co-opted it to use in this system. So typically these are used to actually use track basically salmon in the West Coast and how they're moving in streams for spawning events and stuff like that. And I basically just noticed that there was some people starting to use them to track insect foraging. So I kind of read some blogs, did some research on my own, and figured out that it was possible to actually attach these two larger insects, like bumblebees, and track them. So I kind of started to ask some questions, call some people up, see if I could get my hands on some of the technology. And luckily, one of the other graduate students in the Forest and Wildlife Ecology Department at UW is using these tags for bird research. So I was able to, you know, pick his brain, figure out how he was using this technology, and basically just start designing it to be used with bumblebees.
Wow. Because I actually had the opportunity, it was really cool, to tag monarch butterflies. And that's just they're basically little barcode stickers. So it's just to be able to tell, this butterfly started out in Wisconsin and now it's been found, you know, in Mexico. But what the data that you're collecting is so much more complete. Tell us again what kind of data you're getting off of these transmitters.
Sure. So like I said before, these are like little iPass systems for the bumblebees. And as they leave their nest, it basically registers a time and date stamp. So when they leave the nest and when they come back in the nest. And that allows us to know how long they're out getting nectar and pollen. It allows us to know how often they're going out, how much they're resting in between each of these trips, and we can kind of use those information to develop some sort of a picture of how they're responding to their environment.
Wow. And so you glue them on.
Yep.
And then does that affect, I mean, they're tiny little things, but you're putting them on a tiny little thing. So does it affect how fast they can fly or their balance or anything like that?
So that's what I'm trying to find out right now, actually. I have these large flight chambers set up in our lab, and I'm actually tagging bees and trying to determine how they're affected by these tags. If their foraging is impaired, if they're having a hard time flying. From the data that we got last summer, though, we're showing that they are actually still out foraging, still out gathering pollen and nectar without an issue. And from just observing them flying around, it seems like they don't have too much of an effect. And we want them to behave as naturally as possible.
Mm-hmm,
so the least impact we can have, the better. And the new tags, actually, that we're going to start using, hopefully this summer, are probably a hundredth of the size of the current tags. They're about a millimeter by a millimeter, and that should pose a whole new set of problems for trying to tag them because they're even smaller.
Wow. So that's just incredible. So, and it'll still have all the capabilities of the current tags?
Exactly. The same data, same methods, just a very much smaller tag.
Wow. And so the little iPasses or the little bee Fitbits are collecting this data. How do you then get the data? Is it just automatically like transmitted from that little transponder?
I wish it were. So I actually have a reader set up on top of all of my, I have these little managed bumblebee colonies that I actually purchased to use for these experiments. And I have a little reading unit that's set up on top of those out in the different field sites that I put these in. And I have to actually go out and collect the data manually. So I have to go with my computer and plug it into the little computer chip that's in there and then download all of the data. So I have to actually get pretty close to the colonies when they're in their normal mode. And that can be a little bit of a challenge. I have been chased out of a couple of fields by angry bumblebees as I kind of move their nest around to try to get at the data. But it's a fun challenge.
You can't train them to plug their little transponder in.
Unfortunately, no.
Not yet. Maybe with
not
the smaller
yet.
One. We are talking with Claudio Gratton and Jeremy Hemberger about this really fascinating project to tag bumblebees and get information about their foraging habits, which of course can then help all of us support those important pollinators. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And we will get back to all of those really interesting logistics, but let's go to the phones. And Mandy in Lafarge is up. Hi, Mandy.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
I'm a rural landowner, and we're in the CSP program to create a pollinator habitat. They, you know, have a financial incentive on your taxes or whatever to create that. And we made some bumblebee nest boxes. And I'm wondering if the guests could talk a little bit about, you know, where's the best place to put those? Is there a certain direction they need to be oriented? What kind of nesting materials we should be putting in them? Or do we put them out for the bees to gather and take into the nest box? And then also, what time of, I don't know if they're using them or not. So what's a good time of the year to, you know, say, tear into one and see if they're being used? I don't want to mess anything up if they're, you know, have babies in there.
Sure. No, that's great, Mandy, and great to hear landowners getting involved. Claudia, what is that CSP program?
It's the Conservation Security Program. There's all kinds of cost share programs that the federal government has that encourages landowners to take on these kinds of practices that can actually help pollinators and actually help wildlife more generally. There are some that are actually more agriculturally related, some that are kind of for private lands. I'm so excited that Mandy is involved in these. Yeah, so pollinator nest boxes. So just a little description. What these usually consist of is a collection of hollow tubes. Sometimes people use straws, like drinking straws or paper straws. Sometimes we use bamboo stakes that we chop off at the end so that you kind of have a long hollow tube. And you bundle them together and then put them in a sheltered place. And basically what happens is the bees that like those kinds of areas to nest in will just go right into them and start setting up shop. It's so fun to actually watch them go in. So our experience with those has been that the biggest problems we have is actually getting ants in them. So if you can do anything to keep ants out, I think you'll increase your success at keeping the nest boxes happy. And usually what we do is we set them up in a bucket that we set on its side, and then we attach it to a metal post, or I guess you could use a fence post or something like that. And then we wrap the base of the fence post with duct tape, and we spread the sticky glue on it that keeps the ants from crawling up the fence post. And that's helped us out a lot in keeping the ants out.
Could you even use the duct tape with the sticky side out?
You could, actually? Yeah.
But maybe with water and stuff, it'll not be
sticky.
They
kind of wear over the summer, and dust gets on it, and they lose their stickiness. Yeah. So you can buy this stuff. It's called Tanglefoot. Sometimes it comes in a spray can, so you can actually spray it onto different surfaces. Mm. Don't get it on your hands or your clothes. You'll never get it out. It's a real mess.
You're just saying that theoretically, right?
No,
not that you've ever done it.
It never happens. But there's ways to get it out. If you go online, you can actually find blog posts on how to get it out. The other thing is that we try to put them in areas that get good sun exposure. Mm. So south-facing areas, we usually put them up against kind of forest or wood plots, looking out over onto a prairie onto an agricultural area, something like that. Those we've had the best success
with. Is that because they like a warmer environment?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, if they can warm up, they'll develop faster. You can actually kind of go up to them and see the bees going in. And at the end of the season, if you bring them in, you can look inside and you can actually see some of the stems colonized. They'll often get lined with little bits of grass or little pieces of leaves that the bees actually use to line the particular tubes. So that's a good indication that that you have something going on. And then they'll emerge in the spring. That's typically what happens. Hmm. What we do is we bring them into our labs, and then we wait for things to emerge, and we try to speed up the process. And usually by this time, kind of March, April, in the lab where it's nice and warm, things have pretty much come out.
Oh, okay.
Otherwise, you know, April, May, that's when the next generation starts to come out. I wouldn't really mess with them before then.
Is that helpful, Mandy?
Well, yeah, but I was talking in particular about bumblebee nest boxes that would be more on... I have them on the ground now, and maybe that's the wrong thing to do, but not the tube type, more of a...
Yes.
More of a bee house type
yep.
of thing.
Yep, yep.
You've got these kind of square boxes, and they have a little piece of pipe about, I think a 3/4 inch pipe going in for an entrance.
All right. And I think Jeremy has actually some information for you on that, Mandy.
Yeah, definitely. So this is kind of similar to the systems that we're actually using in our research, and kind of the best areas to put those are going to be where bumblebees would typically nest anyway. So they typically nest in ground, bare ground areas. So if you can put this colony box somewhere out where there would be bare ground where they could be able to get into an abandoned rodent's nest or something like that, that's where they're going to have the best rate of success within that. It's going to be a little more challenging just because you're only relying on a single queen bee to find that nest box. So obviously the more of them that you can put out, the better. And to get an idea if they're being colonized or not, you really just have to go and watch. Or if you can devise a mechanism so you can peek inside, you can do that, but you also want to be careful not to disturb them too much because they're typically used to being underground and in the dark. So if you lift up the lid and it gets light all of a sudden and there are bees in there, they're going to get pretty upset.
It's again, just theoretically speaking,
just
right?
Theoretically
not that you've
speaking,
ever experienced.
Never happened.
So bumblebees are just, to me, they're so cool. They're so much fun. To me, that's the beginning of spring. You go out and you look around and there's these gigantic black things flying around when it's 50 degrees outside and the wind is blowing. And these are the queens that have overwintered and they've come out looking for a place to nest. And as Jeremy said, they try to find old rodent burrows or rotting pieces of something that they can excavate. I had them in my compost heap one year. And if you've never seen a bumblebee colony, we actually have a live stream.
I was going to say, let's make sure we let people know about
that. We've purchased these from a commercial supplier for our research purposes, and we've outfitted one with a little webcam, and you can go online right now. I think there's a link on the WPR
site.
Yes,
we'll make sure that's up there. I can't remember if we got it up or not, but we will definitely put it up.
Yeah, and they look completely different than a honeybee colony, so it's just fun to watch. And basically what happens is the queen lays the first batch of eggs. She takes care of them very carefully. And then those workers that come out are the ones that we see in the middle of the summer going out and getting pollen and nectar mm-hmm. to build that colony for the rest of the year.
And so bumblebees, actually, Jeremy, why don't you just describe what they look like? Because there are a lot of bees around.
There are a ton, yes. So bumblebees are the typical, I think, one of those charismatic bee species that people think of. So they're the big black and yellow fuzzy little teddy bears, as I've called them in the past. And there are a number of different species present in Wisconsin. And typically, like Claudio said, we see them from anywhere from April all the way to October. And we'll typically see the queens in the springtime, and then eventually the workers will start emerging, and we'll see those throughout the duration of the rest of the summer. So they're the largest native bee species that we have here in Wisconsin.
I always think of them as looking like they're too heavy to fly.
Exactly. It almost looks impossible when you see them.
And then
around.
You put the little backpack on them.
They're very strong flyers. They have a lot of really cool adaptations that allow them to generate even more lift than they're supposed to have by conventional standard.
Wow. Well, thanks for that call, Mandy. Let's move on to Pat in Duluth. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I wanted to, first of all, thank you for your research and the great information, and I think your passion for these creatures. And I wanted to let you know that on Saturday in Minong at a garden conference, I'm going to be actually telling gardeners how to garden for pollinators and beneficial insects. And I'm basically going to focus on native bees and some wasps and some others, too, but those two will be the main focus. And I also wanted to ask if you had a website.
Absolutely, yes. So our lab has a website. It's pretty simple. It's just graton.entomology.wis.edu. Or if you just Google Graton Lab, it should be the first hit.
And that's Graton.
Correct, yep.
Okay.
And what's the name of that conference in Minong?
It's called the New Ventures Garden Conference.
New Ventures Garden Conference.
And I think they've been doing that for like 14 years maybe, and it's a nice conference, but it'd be great if, you know, my talk would be for the average gardener who wants to help pollinators and beneficial insects.
Great. Well, thank you so much for that, Pat. I really do think there is a lot of interest in supporting pollinators.
Definitely, yes. We actually have a number of initiatives started here at Wisconsin to help with that. In addition to our lab, there are a couple of other labs interested in pollinator research. And the student and Wisconsin chapter called the Wisconsin Society for Conservation Biology is actually going to be hosting a bee fest, that we're calling it, June 14th at the Arboretum. And it's going to involve a number of different events, including some talks by bee researchers and by the Arboretum folks. And additionally, it's going to have some hands-on training for some bee surveys that we're hoping to set up throughout the course of this summer. So it'll allow people to get out and help identify bees, help conserve bees, and help kind of figure out different ways they can be involved. If they can't plant stuff in their own backyard,
wow.
They can
so
come in and be
a
part
science.
Of our... Exactly, yep.
That's great. Thank you so much for that, Pat. Let's go back to the phones and Chuck in Wausau. Hi, Chuck.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
Hey, the question I've got, you're talking about straws and stuff for the nests.
Mm-hmm.
Several months ago, you had a thing on where you block of wood, like firewood, and drill 3/8-inch holes into it about 1.5-2 inches deep. Is that for honeybees or is that for parasitic wasps?
All right, I've got lots of nodding entomologists in front of me. So, Claudio.
Yeah, that's a very common way to build these nest boxes, is to do exactly what you said, drill the holes. And then often they are lined with paper straws. So if you drill them just right, you can actually fill them with the straws. And those are for bees. Those are for the native bees. They're stem nesting bees, mason bees, that will do exactly what you will do exactly that. They'll go into the straws and set up their shop there. And then what you can do at the end of the year is actually pull the straws out and put them in other parts of the environment, and you could reuse those blocks year after year.
Wow.
You use the same environment in terms of out of the way for everything else and protect it from people and kids running around.
Protect it, exactly, yeah.
Great. Well, yeah, that sounds like a great project. Thanks for bringing that up, Chuck. Let's go back to the phones and Paul in Kenosha. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I agree with you about how interesting bumblebees are this early spring. My question is about mason bees and the nesting boxes for those. A friend wants to put a mason bee nesting box on my place. Well, I'm allergic to honeybee venom. And I wonder, I don't think mason bees are as aggressive as most honeybees. And I don't know if what their venom's like. I've never been stung by a mason bee. Do you know anything about that? And also, can people move like a whole nesting box with the bees from one place to another? It sounded like she wanted to move a box that had mason bees in it to my place, or do you just put up the box and hope that the bees will come? And how do you attract the kind of bees that you want to the nesting box?
That's a good question. How do you get the visitors you want? Jeremy?
Yeah, sure. So I kind of start from the top of the list, I guess, from what you had. And typically people who are allergic to honeybees will often have display symptoms of being stung by another bee, so that is an issue. However, the mason bees and the other native bees that we have here typically are a little bit more docile. They're not quite as aggressive as honeybee colonies because they're solitary. There are lower amounts of individuals. They're not going to be conglomerated in a very large or small area where there's tons of different bees, so you can worry a little bit less about that.
But I do want to say that honeybees in general are actually very docile bees to start with. In fact, that's why we domesticated them in the first place. So you can do a lot to a honeybee without really getting having any trouble with them.
And then as far as moving the nesting boxes go, definitely can be done. We do it in our research. And what's nice about this is that once the female bee visits the nest and she lays eggs in there, those larvae are essentially going to be ready to go at any point, and they can be released at any different environment. They don't need to be in the same environment that their egg is laid in. They're not tied to that in any specific way. The only issue is if you're moving the box during the course of the summer, you risk some of the bees actually emerging while you're moving the box, which can be a conflict if you are allergic to them.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul. And we have just a few minutes left. The time's really flown. But what are the next steps in your research, Jeremy?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hoping to kind of take this a little bit further this coming summer and kind of expand what I've been doing. We had a very small pilot study last year, which is trying to figure out how to do this because it hasn't been done a lot before. So we got our methods figured out. And this year, we're hoping to kind of take things a little bit further and expand how many sites we're using for our research and kind of start tagging a bunch more bees with these smaller tags to see if we can't get the data that we need. Right now, we're kind of assuming that we're going to get a lot more. The tags that we're using right now aren't the best for this. They work really well, but I'm thinking that the technology that we're switching to is going to be a lot better.
How many bees do you have tagged right now?
Currently, we don't have anything tagged. Okay. I'm just in the process of getting this experiment set up in our lab, but we will be tagging probably between 50 and 100 individuals over the next 6 or 7 weeks and kind of tracking them in this lab study.
Wow, that's really exciting. In just the last minute or so, Claudio, what can each of us do to support pollinators, even if we have just a small urban backyard?
Absolutely. So the first thing is just recognizing what they need, and they need food and they need shelter. So plantings, in particular of native plants, I think is something that if you have the space for it and you have the ability to do that, would be a fantastic thing. If those plants can be flowering at different times of the season, I think that's a really good thing for bees so that they don't just have
a constant source.
Yeah, they have something in the fall. They have something in the middle of the summer. I think that's great. One thing I've had great success with actually is container gardening. They love mints. They love oregano and lavender and things like that. So let a little bit of your oregano and your thyme go to flower. And the bees just love that.
Cool.
So I think there's a lot that individually we can do. You can also get involved with some of the activities that Jeremy mentioned, getting involved in the citizen science programs, helping identify where they are. The Arboretum, if you go to their webpage today, has a link about how to take pictures, how to learn to take pictures so that researchers can identify where things are in the state. I think these are all things that can help with pollinator conservation in the long run.
Great. And we'll definitely make sure that we remind people as that June Bee Fest comes up that they can attend and find out more about this. Well, the time just flew by. Really fun conversation. Claudio Grattan is a professor of entomology at UW-Madison. Thank you so much for coming.
You're very welcome.
And Jeremy Hemberger is a graduate student focusing on bumblebee foraging and putting the tracking devices on bumblebees to learn more about their foraging habits. Jeremy will definitely want to stay on top of your research. It's really fascinating.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And coming up tomorrow at 11, we're going to talk with the author of Virgin Territory, Exploring the World of Olive Oil. I'm hoping there'll be some good recipes to share as well. And then at 11:45, Rick Cini of faircompare.com shares travel advice and answers your travel questions. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening.